So you're listening to Nonviolence Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Negler. On Nonviolence Radio, we explore the power of nonviolence as it's being applied today in some of the toughest cases that the world is facing, but also we look at those cases where people aren't using nonviolence and try to say, well, here's where this could have happened differently, and this is what we have to do now in order to get to a different kind of solution. And then the way that humanity tends to look at the world is in terms of problems. And so what we try to do is then explore those solutions. So I'm going to bring up my co-host and news anchor right now, Michael Negler, to talk to us a little bit about what nonviolence means today. You came up with a new formula, nonviolence plus the news story equals victory. Can you tell us a little bit about these various aspects of this equation, Michael, and what we can draw, what lessons we can draw from something like that?
I will sure try. Stephanie, thank you. Yes, this came up while I was preparing to give a talk at Sonoma State University last week for their Social Justice Week. And I'm terrible at math, so the formula was NV plus NS equals V, which I'm sure doesn't work out algebraically. But what I mean is we have two communities out there that are both needed, and they need to be coordinated, and right now they aren't. So the one community is the community of nonviolent activists and theorists who are encouragingly great in numbers and in coordination and in increased sophistication, as we've been pointing out on the news section of this program from time to time. So all of that is very good in itself. Now, the other community, I guess I'll call the new story community. These are theorists who are trying to understand and facilitate what has often been called a paradigm shift. It's a shift from the old story of materialism and separateness to a new story of spirituality and unity. And my point is, I'm quite convinced about this. In fact, I've written a book about it. And I may even be announcing on this show that the book is actually going to be published one of these days. But my point is that we won't be able to solve anything permanently under the old paradigm. It doesn't make any sense. The power of nonviolence can't be explained under the old paradigm. If I'm a material being and separate from you, why do you care that I'm suffering? What about mirror neurons? What about the fact that when people suffer voluntarily in a cause, it often has a stunning impact on the observers? And that means the opponents and the, what's called the reference public who's watching all of this happen. So in order to even understand nonviolence, we have to ground ourselves in the new story. So my issue is, you know, I've always got something. My issue is that the new story people have almost no awareness of nonviolence. They don't recognize its importance within their story. And the nonviolence people often don't think it's significant. We got to stop the worst of the damage. We've got to, you know, stop the pipeline, stop this, stop that. But not think, sometimes they even say we have to change the culture. But this happens to be where my academic field was, and I think we need to recognize that in order to change the culture, that culture has to be embedded in a new framework, a new worldview, a new paradigm, whatever you want to call it.
And now this idea of changing the culture, as we've seen in the news in the past week and a half, for example, when we heard about the man being dragged off of a United Airlines flight because they overbooked and they used force, the airport used force in order to pull this man off, and everybody was feeling humiliated with this man. And people said, first of all, this is the responsibility of United Airlines. But then people started to go a bit deeper and said, wait a minute, this is the culture that we are living in. Yeah. In, you know, one day we're bombing Syria, the next day we're bombing Yemen, the next day we are pulling people by force off of a plane seat that they paid for. And nobody's intervening. Passerbys are filming, of course, to share that, but nobody knows what to do to stop it in this in the moment.
Good point.
And people are saying, wait a minute, this is not one problem. This is the problem of who we believe we've become as a culture. Say something about that.
That's a superb comment, Stephanie, because I was going to go on to say that there is a core of the old story and a core of the new story, which is where the most dramatic and most practical shift has to happen. And then we think of the words of Martin Luther King, we must rapidly begin the shift from being a thing-oriented civilization to a person-oriented civilization. So what it comes down to is, what do you think the human being is? If you think the human being is an expendable customer and the corporation comes first, which of course is the theory behind, the implicit theory behind Citizens United, then this is what you do. The customer is in our way for making money, or the environment is in our way, the human being is in our way, drag them out. Let's take another example, which in a way is more grievous, and that is the dropping of this fantastically destructive weapon on Afghanistan by the United States military 2 days ago. It was already bad enough that they had these weapons that sucked air out of a cave to asphyxiate the Taliban fighters who were hiding in them in the first wave of the assault. If you don't mind, I'm reminded of a story. Just before the war on Afghanistan was launched to avenge 9/11, I was giving a talk in Quaker House in a little town called Lewis in near Brighton in the south of India. South of England, I'm sorry. More recently, I was in the south of India, in the south of England. And there was a woman in the audience who was extremely upset. In fact, she was crying so hard that she could hardly get her story out. But I asked her to, and she said that she had spent a lot of time in Afghanistan. Now, this is a country which has like between 1 and 3 inches of rain a year. So they are very, very dependent on water resources. And all the mountains have these very complicated, very vulnerable aqueducts that have been in service. They're man-made. They've been in service for hundreds of years, maybe more. One bomb will wipe out a whole system of aqueducts. So she knew how destructive that would be to human life. Nothing that was ever taken into account when the military decision was made. So once again, the disregard for people, the disregard for the land that we live in the service of a military, in this case, or financial good. So we must shift to a different vision of who we are. And in the film that we're putting together at the Meta Center, I've been really gratified how many of the great nonviolent activists that we have interviewed for that film have said exactly this, that nonviolence implies a different vision, a different image of who we are. And in fact, I think that the core of that vision, so now we're moving, the core of the story is the human image. The core of the human image, from my point of view and yours, is the human being's capacity for nonviolence. And when I say capacity for nonviolence, I mean both the capacity to offer it, and that's the term that Gandhi always used, you're offering satyagraha to the opponent, and the capacity to recognize it.
In a short sentence yesterday, I heard in a video from Eknath Ishwaran that the human being is a powerful force for love. And I thought, well, that sounds nice, but what does it really mean? And it occurs to me that this is really a way of shifting our image of who we are, because when the implicit understanding that I have when I hear about the news and that the mainstream media has let us know about, we can really do nothing about that, these things are happening, and bombs and harm that we're perpetuating all over the world in the United States. To think that the human being is a force for love, then why are we so destructive? And I think that that has something to do with understanding how destructive we can be is also a sign of how powerful we can be when we shift that vision. What do you think?
Well, Socrates said exactly that. When he was in prison and awaiting execution, his friend said to him, "You've underestimated the power of what the Greek term hoi polloi, meaning roughly the masses. The masses are all powerful. Look what they're doing to you." And he said, "I only wish that the masses had the extreme power for evil, because if they did, they'd have the extreme power for good. Mm-hmm. But as it is, all they can do is take away my body. Mm-hmm. They can't kill what I stand for."
Mm-hmm. So shifting back to this idea of new story and nonviolence, so what we're saying is that shifting the human, you call it in the sort of the new story people, and I'm not sure who those people are, and I'm not sure about how understood or recognized that community actually is. But basically, it's the pockets of thinkers in the world who are saying that the human beings are super cooperators, that we are, or people who have spiritual practices who are trying to say that everything is about consciousness and we just have to put our mind to things. You're saying that that's the community in particular that has a lot of power in it because they're unearthing sort of spiritual reality and quantum reality about who we are as people, but they're missing this piece of nonviolence. And what do you mean, besides that the human being is a force for good? I mean, nonviolence is more than that. How would you describe or define nonviolence in this way that we have the capacity to do what?
Whoa, challenging. I think I'd say we have the capacity to tap into a power that's much greater than ourselves, our individual capacity that we are aware of. And that of that power, Gandhi said, it is the greatest power on earth, that it can move things where violence and coercion fail. And Martin Luther King pointed out that we accomplished more in 10 days in the South than people had accomplished in 100 years trying to use violence.
Mm-hmm. So you're almost getting there. I guess for some people, it's still not clear what nonviolence is, because it isn't. So tapping into the power that brings people out into the street to protest, or what if you're not a protester? What if you're not interested in that kind of thing? Does that mean that you don't have this capacity for nonviolence? Does it mean that you're just working in a company and you are being more personable with your employees? You know, that doesn't seem very strong of a shift in our world. So what do you mean by, it's still not clear what you mean exactly by nonviolence. And I guess, Michael Nagler, I'm asking you this question because you said you're writing a book about it, and I want to prepare you for this kind of critique, because it isn't always fully clear for somebody who's not studying it every day.
Yeah, I've often experienced that here, I've schlogged my way through all of these arguments, and I realize that most of my friends that I'm talking to have not. They just haven't taken that time. So you do need to go back. You're making me think of the dramatic case of Adel Termos. He was a Lebanese man who's in a market in Beirut, and there was a suicide bomb that went off, and he looked up and he saw there was another bomber about to blow himself up. And Termos ran over to him and threw himself on that man, knocking him to the ground, so that, of course, they both died instantly. And he did that because his 9-year-old daughter was in the crowd, and he saved his daughter and perhaps quite a few other people. Now, in the news reports from all over the world, as far as I was able to see, if they commented on this in a general way at all, they said, this violated human nature. Mm-hmm. He broke human nature. Mm-hmm. But what I'm saying is that was human nature. That was human nature on display. Mm-hmm. That was human nature evoked. And yes, we have, okay, scientists don't really use the word instinct anymore, but we're not scientists, so let's use it real quick. Yeah, we have an instinct for self-preservation. You know, if I step out of the studio and somebody is thrown something across the studio, I'm going to duck. But we also have an instinct for self-sacrifice. Mm-hmm. And here's where I actually get to the answer to your very good question. That instinct for self-sacrifice is a pointer in the direction of who we really are, that we really are not separate individuals. We participate in the whole. And so when we use our human will to make that participation visible, we are displaying reality in a deeper way than we do when we just try to protect ourselves and protect our own and so forth. And that's what gives it its power. That's my theory. That's because it's like you're seeing the future. You're seeing a glimpse into who we really are, though all of our conditioning is guaranteed to conceal that from us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So for those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Nonviolence Radio, and Michael Nagler and I are exploring this idea of the way that shifting the human image, which is called the new story, and nonviolence, and how we're trying to define it as sort of coming out to the displaying of reality of our deeper human nature, of our interconnectedness that is proven scientifically at this point, and I'm going to get into that in a second, is the way forward for nonviolence, because it is terribly difficult to understand or make sense of the world that we live in, where we can drag people off of planes and feel powerless to intervene in that situation or know what to say or know what to do. And by the way, we can get trained it's called bystander intervention training, and you can get involved in trainings like that to learn what to do in situations. But where when giant bombs are dropped on poor countries that we've paid for, these are ways of, it's hard to understand what we can do about that if we don't shift these two things. First of all, having a deeper understanding about another power than violence and another image of who we are. And even if we just had an idea about another power of nonviolence, it's going to be a very weak kind of nonviolence if we don't shift the image of who we are. And similarly, we can shift the image of who we are, but if we don't include how to use that image through the power of nonviolence, then it's a missing puzzle piece. So they really have to go together. Now, Michael knows that I am a preschool teacher at a Montessori school in Petaluma. We work with 3 to 6 year olds, 16 of them all in one classroom, and we do a Pledge of the Earth. And in the Pledge of the Earth, we talk about economic justice, restorative justice, equal rights, and peace and love for all. And the children talk about this together, and they repeat this passage before we come inside from our outdoor classroom, aka our playground. And I'm also doing a peacemaker training with these children. Now, a couple days ago in our classroom, in our outdoor classroom in our playground, two of the kindergartners were playing a game that included violence in it, and they know that we usually stray away from those kinds of games because we don't practice harming others. We understand that when we practice harming, we're setting ourselves up for harming somebody one day. We're understanding how to harm others, and we try to consciously cultivate an understanding of practical nonviolence. So they were already crossing the line in that way of playing just a normal playground game of somewhat violent behaviors involved. And it escalated. It got out of control. So where one child hit the other in the back hard, where we could hear it, and left a mark on him. And he turned around and was quite upset, thought for a minute, and then hit the other child back. And then I leave at 1:30. So there was a little bit of a debrief about what happened, but not much. So the next day during our peacemaker training, I talked about, well, you know, peacemakers practice restorative justice. What is restorative justice? Well, it's going beyond punishment, and it's trying to understand that when harm is done in our community, it hurts everybody, not just the people that it happened to, and that the physical violence that took place was painful in one way, but the relationship that was broken is even more painful. And we went around, and all of these children, 4, 5, and 6 year olds, explored this idea of saying, what happened? What did I do in this situation, including the two children who were the ones who hit each other. So we opened it up to the whole community and how it felt when this happened. And what it brought out was that everybody was affected by the violence and it hurt everybody. And we had insights of one little girl pointed out, when so-and-so hit so-and-so, he hit them right in their heart. And then, but then we thought about it and, you know, both of the children hit each other in the heart region and how that was just so symbolic of how all of our hearts had been broken by this violation of each other's body through violence. And slow, but they, so to bring children that age through a restorative justice process where we tried to repair that relationship, but also show that we were all interconnected and we all felt harmed by that violence in some way, was very, very powerful. Because it also, we also juxtaposed that with a little boy who had wanted something from our classroom, and we all voted except for one child that he should be able to take it home. It was our peacemaker cape that they sometimes, we have a peacemaker on the playground. And so he, this one child wanted to take it home. One girl decided that she would rather have it hanging in the classroom. Sort of like somebody made, you know, everybody made the case of why he should be able to take it home. She finally agreed that, okay, I can let go of the cape. And we let her give him the cape to take home, gave her the opportunity to give it to him. And he felt good and she felt good. And so we were able to juxtapose that situation of, remember how happy we all felt when Johnny got the peace cape just half an hour ago and how good that felt to all of us? It shows that we're all interconnected. So we really did combine at that in that meeting the way that our interconnection is deeply tied to our practice of nonviolence, and that healing was so visceral at that time. And so just as an example to show that this interconnection is real and that through a practice of nonviolence, such as restorative justice, we can really bring that to light. Michael Nagler.
Well, I sure wish I went to that school.
Yeah, it was
public school 193 was not like that.
Right.
That's wonderful, very encouraging to hear, Stephanie. And in case you're wondering in our audience, I had not heard that story before. It shows how, since we acculturate children at a very early age to overlook the connectedness and act harmfully towards others and toward themselves, which is probably the most important part, it would be just as easy to do the opposite if we just did it a little bit intentionally.
Well, even not with children. I mean, what would it look like if we had, because the outrage of the violence by the peace community in particular, and we want to represent all sides on Nonviolence Radio because that is nonviolence, but the peace community is feeling outraged about using weapons because it's a specific president's violence, but it was less outrageous when other presidents used similar violence because we liked other presidents better. So that's a little tricky situation. But what we're showing is that we're outraged by violence in any case, that it's bringing that to light. And that outrage itself is an expression of that interconnection. It hurts us. And then we have more right-wing media pointing out, well, just how necessary this kind of violence was. But even that expression of this, you know, this was really necessary is covering up that feeling of being interconnected. It's trying to say, you feel interconnected, but we did the right thing. Don't worry. So what would look like if our media were telling us that same thing that we talked to these children about at the school in restorative justice? Wow, this situation really hurt all of us. Maybe we could learn something from that pain that we're all feeling and change our course of direction.
I think it would be useful to actually point out why it hurts.
Mm-hmm.
Because it tears the connection among us, and we feel that. And there's all kinds of evidence, positive and negative. I think of the fact that, well, recently we interviewed Kazuhaga, who's been on this show, and also we interviewed him for our film, and he pointed out that there are 16,000 homicides in the U.S. every year, but there are close to 40,000 suicides. And this is, you know, largely because of the pain and the despair and disorientation people feel, because that interconnection, that beautiful spiritual web in which we are all woven is lost sight of. Now, I think you do the most valuable service possible by pointing out to children how they feel when they do that, because that really is all they need to go on. That's all they need to grow up loving, generous, nonviolent people. And let me point out one thing about, since we've got childhood education on the table, there are quite a few what they call peaceful communities in the world that are either indigenous communities or they are what we call enclaved communities, like the Shakers and Mennonites, who exist in their own culture to a great extent. And they all have in common that they educate, they have a nonviolent culture. Now, one of them has an interesting technique, and I think, it's been a long time, but I think I'm talking about the Shakers, that what they did is they did not interfere with children, no matter how nasty they were to one another, up to the age of 8. I'm not advocating this, by the way. I'm just saying they did it. At the age of 8, the minute there was any kind of hitting or even, you know, bad-mouthing, they said, you don't do that anymore. So people grew up with a very strong impression that violence was childish, which is the exact opposite that we're trying to make out to ourselves, that it's, you know, sensible, manly, all the rest of it.
Those words manly and childish are such, we could dedicate an entire radio show to deconstructing those ideas in the way that they are used in our culture. Mm-hmm. But I'm also reminded that I wrote this book, this children's book called Gandhi Searches for Truth, and I read it to the children during our peacemaker training, and where we were talking about, you know, this situation that took place on the playground where one child hit the other child back after being hit. And the when the children were going around and talking about what they did, one of the children who hit didn't tell the truth, the full truth about what they did. They made it seem like they accidentally hit the other person because they were afraid of being punished, certainly. But so then we got a chance to talk about, you know, how hard it is to cling to the truth. And so this idea, Gandhi searches for truth and Gandhi clinging to truth, became real in a new way. And in chapter 8 of this book, I talk about how Gandhi was on the train in Pietermaritzburg, South Africa, and is kicked off onto the platform for being Indian in first class. And he, at that day, he basically commits the rest of his life to making injustice intolerable and writing it through nonviolent means. He becomes a nonviolent soldier on that day. And he makes a vow that sticks with him for the rest of his life, and it inspires people even today. So it's a huge power. And so we talked about how that even though the one child was hit, what would it have been like if he didn't hit back? And he said that would have been really hard. And so I really got to express to the children that nonviolence is not an easy thing to do. It's not easy not to hit back when everything inside is saying it. And then it says that anger is like kind of a fire. You can use it to light a candle, or you can light it to for destructive purposes. And it was just so amazing that in the context of a childhood fight, those concepts were able to come to light, how difficult nonviolence really is.
You mentioned, Stephanie, that the child was prevaricating a little bit because he was afraid of being punished. I'm sure that's true. But if we stop there, we're stuck in retributive justice. Mm-hmm. 'Cause then we try to use punishment to deter crime, which is a massive failure.
Well, we would use punishment, what punishment made this child do, and I won't say the gender of the child, it might have been a girl.
Not likely.
The issue is that the idea of punishment encouraged people to lie. And so if nonviolence and actual healing comes from the truth, then having a whole culture where we encourage lying means that we're way off track to get back on toward actual healing.
One of the earliest books that I read about restorative justice, which is the answer to all this, is that people who have been incarcerated for acts that harm others, they just cannot tell the truth. It's just psychologically difficult for them at first. And the first step that you take with them by way of restoration is to create an atmosphere in which they can face what they have done, but they do so in the context of being aware that they are much more than that. Mm-hmm. You have to reach out and touch the goodness in the person, and then that becomes a platform on which they can say, yes, I am a good person, and that was an aberration. And then we can solve the problem together.
So we're getting back again to that idea of the human being as a force for good and that need to really raise up that image. You're listening to Nonviolence Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook. I'm here in the studio with my co-host and news anchor, Michael Negler. Michael, let's get back into our interpretation of the news, what's happening on the side of nonviolence in the world, because there's a lot that's happening on the side of violence right now.
You're so right, Stephanie, and there's a lot actually happening on both sides. Mm-hmm. I'm going to follow for the time being the format that we've usually followed in these segments, which is to talk about some resources, some of the news, and then some events, though you have threatened to reorganize these presentations around the idea of our roadmap model, which I like very much.
All right. Stay tuned for our next show for coming out with that idea.
Good. So I just want to remind people about a resource I mentioned in our last show because it is so valuable, and it's from the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. They have an online resource library that has material on what they call civil resistance. I'll get back to that in a minute. In 55 languages, and their website is nonviolent-conflict.org. Now, here's a brand new one. At least it was new to me. Probably a lot of you folks out there, especially millennials, knew about this. But there's a Bernie Sanders show, I'm happy to say. It's on Facebook Live, and it also comes out in podcasts, and because I haven't really yet had the pleasure of hearing one of the shows. So let's just all do that together and share our responses. Now, Stephanie spoke about bystander intervention trainings, and those are happening quite frequently around the country. Recently, there was a series that was done by the Michigan Peace Team, or META Peace Team. That's META with one T. META Peace Team, one word, metapeaceteam.org. And I'm sure there will be more coming up. The National War Resistance Coordinating Committee, which you can find through Google, has a lot of suggestions and instructions about war tax resistance, which you have 2 days now, I think, or 4 days you have to declare some war tax resistance. This is a ongoing effort with a long history, but the recent version of it is being coordinated by our friend Kit Miller of the Gandhi Peace Institute in Rochester, New York, which itself is a good resource.
I believe it's actually the Gandhi Center for Nonviolence. It's a lot like the META Center for Nonviolence, but it's the Gandhi Resource Center for Nonviolence.
I bet you're right, Stephanie. Yeah, thank you. So now a few articles. There were two interesting articles in Waging Nonviolence this week, one by Richard Zunas and one by a colleague by the name of Kudaimi.
Stephen Zunas.
Stephen Zunas. Good thing you're there today. And they talk about the only workable approach to Syria, namely strengthening the democratic nonviolent resistance, which actually was there but was quickly overwhelmed by violent resistance, as is same as what happened in Kosovo in the early 90s. But that leads me to a third article, which is an op-ed by Nicholas Kristof, saying how to resist the president, President Trump. And he points out, we'd like to give you a couple of the highlights with our approbation and a few places where our analysis would be a little bit different. He says that a wave of furious opposition erupted, which is true, that it was an emotional mix of denial and anger, the first two stages of grief, and he goes on to say, and it wasn't very effective. And I want to highlight this because it is a first step that most people rush into. You even cited it a while back, you know, that we're rushing out into the street and protesting. The emphasis there is on venting your feelings, and that's not the same as having an effective impact on the situation. It's like a staging area for a nonviolent campaign. Christoph goes on to say, yet increasingly that has matured into thoughtful efforts to channel the passion into a movement organized toward results, which we could not agree with more. And we remember Martin Luther King's famous formula when he was challenged, you know, your movement caused outbreaks of anger. He said, we did not cause outbreaks of anger. We expressed anger under discipline for maximum effect.
Right. The anger was already there.
It was there. It was on both sides. But instead of letting the anger rule us, I'm putting these words in his mouth, we ruled it. And we did it by exactly the formula that Christoph is pointing to. We channel that emotional power into a strategy, a coherent long-term strategy. But most of the examples that he cites with approval have to do with policies. As, for example, that there was this huge wave of phone calls that torpedoed the Republican, quote, health care plan, unquote. And that's true. But I think people are starting to feel more and more that what we can do with our elected officials is limited. And I'm always recalling how Martin Luther King presented the idea of a Voting Rights Act to President Johnson. LBJ said to him, that's a great idea. Now go out and make me do it. So it's more about preparing the groundwork for progressive change to be adopted at the legislative and judicial levels. Did you have something you wanted to?
I just guess this is the host of Nonviolence Radio, Stephanie. And I find it somewhat disheartening, though, that we have to go out and make people do the right thing. That it's something about that just doesn't hold well for me, that it's the force of doing something the way that it's always been done, even though it's shown to be unjust, unfair, harmful. We have to put so much effort into changing that. Sometimes I think it's overwhelming.
Well, there's no question that there is overwhelm out there, and the only way this has been shown by studies, the only way to avoid overwhelm and burnout is through action. In other words, you act as if you had a capacity to change things, and the first effect of that kind of action is on yourself. It brings you out of your depression and your paralysis. I'm reminded because I just found out today about a documentary film on the life of Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning, that when he was in Auschwitz, he talked about people who had just like a tiny little bit of chocolate was all they owned, and they would break it off and share it with another inmate, another prisoner. And he said, as a psychiatrist, it was extremely important for them to do that, because to act as if you have enough to give overcomes a feeling of deprivation. And similarly, to act as if you were capable overcomes a feeling of paralysis, of helplessness. Only in this case, it happens to be true. You become effective by acting. So Nicholas Christoff goes on to talk about Gene Sharp, because Gene Sharp's outfit was right there with him in Boston, and he says that Sharp's works are in 45 languages and available free online. He says Sharp is the expert on challenging authoritarians, and orders for his writings have surged since Trump's election. Now, we don't really disagree with any of this, but we want to point out that nonviolence has moved further since the production of Gene Sharp's initial seminal and exceedingly useful works. And the kind of personal and spiritual change that we were talking about earlier in this show is an element that has to be added. You have to have that complement to fully understand nonviolence and to fully understand that it's going to need a new paradigm to get it out. Christoph also quotes Sam Daly Harris, who is a master of effective protest, and he argues, with which we would entirely agree, that it should not be just symbolic protest. He's overseen groups like Results and the Citizens Climate Lobby that have had outsized influence on policy. So they're still talking about being within the realm of affecting congressional and legislative change. So we would say, you know, there's a lot more that has to be done on every sector of society, and even the movement in its most sophisticated is often not aware that it has to go deep enough to change the new story, to change the story to a new story. So, but with those caveats, I would strongly urge that people have a look at that New York Times article. It's extremely useful. Mm-hmm. Now, go ahead.
Well, I think that it's important to bring out a point about nonviolence in this analysis that you're making of Christoph's article, is that, let's see how to say it, that there's a principle in nonviolence that is such that, well, it's not that we're not concerned about the results of our actions, but that we are working always with the means themselves. Mm-hmm. So the question of our means versus our ends is extremely important, because the more that we're concerned about getting this person to do what we want, we'll use any means or any shortcuts necessary in order to get them to do that. But the struggle here isn't actually about who is in power, but the kind of power that is in people, as we say very famously at the Meta Center. So we have to really shift this idea from, and maybe that's even the Gene Sharp issue, is that this is nonviolence with an entire focus on the goal. Your goal is to do this. You will do this. Here's some means to get there. And yet we always feel that there's some kind of strange element of violence in those means. So we're trying to take a step back and really examine our means and to see that the victory itself is by maintaining nonviolent discipline.
That is a very important aspect of the victory. And that's one of the reasons that the protesters at Standing Rock feel that by and large it was a hugely successful event, because they were not goaded into breaking down and being violent. And you might remember our friend Hafez Asali in the village of Tuwani in South Hebron Hills saying very, very dramatically, they will never make me be violent. And now the way that you put it might be a bit problematic when you said we're not concerned with results. It's not that we're not concerned with the results, it's that we don't feel that we own them, or, importantly, that we have complete control over them. And when your focus is disproportionately on results, then exactly what you said happens. We have people saying, we will get this done by any means necessary. And then those means come in and corrupt the result.
And so that's what I'm trying to get to in what I just said, is that what our goal really needs to be is creating a nonviolent culture. And the way that we do that is by using nonviolence with such discipline that nothing can shake us from it. So because the change isn't going to happen just by using nonviolent means in order to further the ends of a violent culture, which is basically from another standpoint, it's end result oriented, that we're going to do this X. If we do X, then we achieve Y. If we do, you know, S, mm-hmm. then we achieve Z. So
let me restructure a little bit what you said, which I entirely agree with. I think our issue, another problem with focusing on goals is we don't put it in the context of an overriding goal. And that's where Gandhi really shone. His overriding goal was to elevate human consciousness, to show human beings that they were capable of nonviolence and what nonviolence can do. So that in his vision, even the liberation of India, even the ending of the colonial era, the dissolution of the British Empire as such, was a means to a higher goal. And I think because the atrocities that we're facing are so urgent and so very painful, it's easy for us to lose sight. And one way to keep a focus on the means, not the end, is to remember that overriding goal. You know, as he said, violent revolution will bring us violent Swaraj, violent freedom. So if we were aware that what we want is a nonviolent freedom, we'll do everything that's a step in that direction. And those will inevitably be nonviolent in character. So to move on a little bit onto our news section, I'd like to say that there is a civilian Camp David coming up at George Mason University, which is in combination with the National Peace Academy. And I really like this idea because it's a joint effort by a freestanding long-term peace organization, National Peace Academy, and a university, an institution. We've cited a few cases of that with our friend Stellan Vinthagen at Amherst once before. So I want to talk for a minute about a disturbing phrase that was used in connection with this enormous bomb that destroyed everything for 1,000 yards around it in Afghanistan recently. And that was the expression that this was the mother of all bombs. I want to say two things about that. First, I hate it. But first, that this is really a copying of a statement that was attributed to Saddam Hussein, that this is the mother of all battles. Mm-hmm. And it shows how when we become violent, we become the shadow image of our opponent. We become like them.
Goodness that we're using the notion of something so precious as motherhood to express an extremely violent force.
That was exactly my second point and the more important one. And I want to talk briefly about the role of euphemism. Mm-hmm. In a way, the use of euphemism for violent methods and violent tools is a good sign in a funny way because it shows we can't face what we've actually done. But it becomes a very harmful sign when we conceal from ourselves the damage that we're actually doing. And this is, to me, this is the problem with corporations. You go into a corporation and you're no longer responsible. Because as a corporation, the corporation can do things that you don't have to take responsibility for as an individual. In fact, the German word for corporation, Gesellschaft mit begrenzten Heften, means an organization with limited responsibilities. Mm. And I believe that when you deprive a person of his or her responsibilities, you're really cutting them off again from something very essential in their nature. And even if that is not true, I'm pretty darn sure it is, you are facilitating a lot of violence. And I am always reminded of something that Adolf Eichmann said during his trial in Jerusalem. Someone asked him, how could you do these things? And he said, our language made it possible, because they described everything in terms of bland, emotion-free euphemisms. Incidentally, a lot of our mass media describes things without appropriate emotion and kind of feeds into this habit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Michael, let me interrupt you before you go too far, because I know that this is one of the places that you feel very passionately. I'd say less about the euphemisms, because then we end up getting into people saying, well, why use nonviolence as a term? It's you're saying violence and you're evoking that thought. Or there's why do you call Gandhi a soldier of nonviolence? Let's not use war terminology whatsoever. And then we become bizarrely searching for different words to use. But I know the point that you're going to, because you talked about it with bombs dropped, like, that were called little man and
fat man and little boy.
Mm-hmm. And so there, I mean, there you have it, that we're giving human characteristics, mm-hmm, and quality to forces of destruction, when what, right, we're trying to do in nonviolence is to, yeah, show that the human being is something different than that. And so every time we drop a bomb or use a form of violence, we're degrading the human image. And this is very intentionally doing so by calling, yeah, the M-O-A-B a mother.
Yeah. Well, I agree, and I also agree that this could be leading to a very complicated argument that I don't want us to get into. So let me go on. There's a very interesting write-up in Huffington Post describing that more than 50 social justice organizations have united to form a new coalition to combat injustice and fight for equality on behalf of all marginalized groups. It's called The Majority, and it includes organizations, of course, like Black Lives Matter, NAACP, Indigenous Environmental Network, Dream Defenders, and so forth. And that's very encouraging. We need more coalition building. We need to step out of our silos and work together. But, you know, I'm so hard to please. I have a little comment to make here, and that is, I wonder if the old form of coalition into a single organization, an umbrella organization, is really the best model anymore. And I'm thinking of a book that was important for me and for all of us at Meta at one time, called The Starfish and the Spider, the subtitle of which was The Unstoppable Power of Leaderless Organizations. So I just want to raise that as a question. Is there perhaps, in addition to these coalitions, is there not perhaps some other format of coordination that we might be exploring? And maybe we should devote a program to that, because I don't really have a quick suggestion to make.
Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, what's really good about that is that instead of working on fragmented issues, people are now starting to come together and saying, wait a minute, our mistreatment is your mistreatment, and we'll be stronger together. And as long as that keeps growing, that's going to be really awesome. The challenge would be that we're only strong if we're a majority, because in nonviolence, we also have to understand the principle that at times you're going to be a minority.
A majority of one.
A majority of one, and you have to be able to face criticism and really tough circumstances in order to uphold the vision that you're, yeah, holding. So that's the razor's edge of nonviolence. There's always something to learn, and yet to continue to grow, because it is not, yeah, just a tactic. It's a state of consciousness. It's a higher realm of action.
Both points very well taken, that we do need to coordinate, but at the same time, we shouldn't feel that we're powerless unless we coordinate, because the individual has incredible untapped power. And as Sri Ishwaran likes to point out, when Mahatma Gandhi came back to India, he was one person, and the nation was 300 million. And by the time he was finished, they were all behind him. But really, that power came from his transformation,
yes,
in South Africa.
And it's also going to come from seeing ourselves in a higher light. So yeah, that the idea of being a majority, I think, is also a, yes, very strong image, instead of saying we're the, yeah, oppressed,
exactly,
for example, which is true. It's absolutely, there is oppression, and that is happening. But self-identifying is only going to get so far. And that, and a lot of authors these days social critiques for movement activism that people are learning from are saying similar things, is that we're not going to get so far.
To say we are the oppressed leads, yeah, to helplessness and anger. You're absolutely right. If you want to find out more about this, look at beyondthemoment.org, or use the hashtag #beyondthemoment.
So this has been another episode of Nonviolence Radio. Thank you so much to our mother station, KWMR. to all of our listeners, to all of the staff and friends of the Meta Center for Nonviolence. And until the next time, everybody, take care of one another and see what you can do to learn a little bit about nonviolence in the meantime.